For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
I'm very happy to have with us tonight Jean Reeves, who's been here two or three times before. Anyway, Jean is, his translation of the Lotus Sutra, I consider now the standard English translation. He's also an eminent scholar of the Lotus Sutra. He's written or edited a few books by now about the Lotus Sutra. Jean has been living in Beijing, but is moving back to Tokyo. He also spent some of the time in Chicago and used to be teacher at the University of Chicago Divinity School and dean of the Meadville Lombard Unitarian Seminary, Theological School. And some of you have heard Jean before, and for the rest of you, this is a treat, and I want to thank you for coming again, Jean. Welcome.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for having me here. It's always, I think this is the third, it might be the fourth, but I think it's the third time.
Maybe so, like that, lose count.
that I've come here to share some of my ideas about the Lotus Sutra with you. And it's always a pleasure. It's a nice, warm, comfortable feeling to be here. This evening I'm going to talk about Chapter 10 of the Lotus Sutra. The title of it is Dharma Teachers or Dharma Teacher. You know, in Chinese and Japanese, we don't make a distinction between singular and plural unless we really need to. So it could be interpreted either way. I announce that this chapter is the most outrageous, shocking chapter of the book to be found anywhere else. But I won't claim that it's the most important. From the time of Jiri and what we would call at least the first East Asian school of Buddhism, that is non-Indian school of Buddhism, the first one, is in Chinese Tiantai, and from the time of the founder of Tiantai, Jiri, chapters 2 and 16 have been regarded as the core chapters of the Lotus Sutra. The text as a whole is commonly been regarded as having two halves or two halves and an appendix, and the core of the first half is understood to be chapter 2, and the core of the second half is understood to be chapter 16. Chapter 2 teaches the idea of skillful means, which, as you probably know, has become a very important part of the whole of East Asian Buddhism, a key teaching and a key way of understanding the development of Buddhism in East Asia. Chapter 16 is the chapter that teaches the ongoing life of the Buddha. The actual title of it would be the lifetime of the Tathagata. And so I'm not trying to claim that chapter 10 is more important in some way than chapters 2 and 16. I kind of like that tradition of making chapters 2 and 16 central to the two halves of the sutra. But here's chapter 10, sort of in the middle of them. In terms of the formation of the sutra itself, probably the first nine chapters fall into one development, and the next 11 chapters fall into a later development. But we can't be very sure about that, and chapter 10 obviously falls in the middle of there. And it is, I think, an extremely important, and as I say, shocking development of Mahayana Buddhism. But maybe as background, I ought to say a word about the Lotus Sutra itself, which understands itself to be a shocking book. From the Lotus Sutra's own perspective, probably the most shocking teaching of the Lotus Sutra is the teaching of the ongoing life of the Buddha. You know, in classical Indian Buddhism, even today in Theravada Buddhist countries, the word Buddha is referring to one historical person. And it's in the development of Mahayana Buddhism and the further development of it, of Mahayana in East Asia, that we get a kind of proliferation of Buddhas. Dan and I disagree a little bit about this fellow who's sitting in the middle of this room. I think this is Amida Buddha, but and he thinks it's Shakyamuni Buddha, and it obviously could be either one. But we do get Medicine Buddha and a whole lot of other Buddhas that proliferate in Mahayana Buddhism. In India, before Buddhism goes to China, and there are further developments in China which would be a digression to talk about right now. But the main point of the Lotus Sutra, it has a kind of strategy for this. It begins early on by telling us that Shariputra, normally understood to be a follower of the Buddha who is a shravaka, a monk, an ordinary monk, and a monk, therefore, in the Theravada, what we would now call a Theravada tradition, in the classical tradition. And we're told that, or actually he is told, this monk, Shariputra, is told that he, though he wasn't aware of it, he actually has been practicing the Bodhisattva way, not merely a Shravaka, but practicing the Bodhisattva way, and therefore he is going to become a Buddha in some future time. And then a little while later, we get a story about four leading Shravakas, and they're told that they're going to become Buddhas. And the story builds up until finally, here in chapter 10, it's said that everyone is going to become a Buddha someday. It may take a lot of time, but someday everyone is going to become a Buddha. So the main, and the point of all of that is, of course, or maybe it's not so, of course, it's really not about something out there. The main point of the teaching that everyone is to become a Buddha is really not that everyone is to be a Buddha. That's irrelevant. What's really being taught is that you are going to become a Buddha, and he's going to become a Buddha, and he's going to become a Buddha. Everyone in one sense, but it's each one is going to become a Buddha. And that's what the Lotus Sutra really wants to impress upon. And that's the meaning. That's the literal meaning of the teaching of the everlasting life of the Buddha. It isn't the Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical person who walked around on the earth a couple thousand, or maybe 2,500 years ago. It's not that he's still somehow living up in the heavens. No. It is that he is still alive, or what was alive in him is still alive in us. And the Lotus Sutra even suggests that the ongoing life of the Buddha is not inevitable. As long as somebody keeps the Buddha alive, as long as somebody teaches the Dharma to somebody else, then the wheel rolls on, and the Buddha continues to live. But the Lotus Sutra is always holding out the possibility that we might forget, and that Buddhism, the Dharma, could die. And so part of what's being taught there, part of what's being encouraged there, is for us, the readers of the text, to continue to teach the Dharma and to develop. Yeah, I said develop, and I think it really means to develop the Dharma, not just to continue the tradition, but to help it grow, flourish, flower. And that's probably why it's called the Dharma Flower Sutra. Lotus Sutra is a European invention. It's in Japanese and Chinese, it's never called the Lotus Sutra. It's always the Dharma. We could even say, multiple translations are always possible. We could always say that the title of the text is The Flowering of the Dharma. And it's really encouraging us not only to, not just to perpetuate a tradition. That is important. It's very important that the Dharma be continued. But it's perhaps more important, or just as important, that the Dharma be developed in new contexts, situations, and new individuals, new people. So that's what the text is really about. It's not so much about certain doctrines. It's not about, though it has doctrines, skillful means can be understood as a doctrine. It has doctrines, but that's not what it's really about. And it's not about certain terms. It has certain technical language that it uses. Skillful means, upaya being one of them. But that's not what the text is about. It's really trying to change our hearts and minds, and more importantly than our hearts and minds, our very lives, how we live our lives. And a part of that is to be embodying. I've been using the word teaching the Dharma. But one of the ways for the Lotus Sutra in which we teach the Dharma is by embodying it. Bodily teaching, it's often been called. So that's what the text as a whole is kind of about. And we find in this text, it understands that the most shocking thing in the text is this idea about the everlasting, ongoing life of the Buddha. That is what the text says is very, very difficult to believe. There's a story that kind of embodies this in chapter 15, where I'll give you a very short version of this story. We'll be here all night. But in an earlier chapter, some bodhisattvas have been assembled from all over the universe in order to witness the coming together of two Buddhas in a stupa that has emerged from the earth. And now it's time for these bodhisattvas to go back to where they came from. And some of them are feeling kind of sorry for Shakyamuni Buddha. The idea behind this is that every Buddha has a kind of an assignment, responsibility, and somehow Shakyamuni Buddha drew the short straw, and he's the Buddha of this world, where people are kind of stupid, stubborn, difficult to teach, and just give you a hard time. And so some of these bodhisattvas from other worlds, they're feeling sorry for Shakyamuni Buddha for having drawn this responsibility, and they go up to him and they say, before they go home, and they go up to him and they say, "We'd like to volunteer to stay here and help you out. We think you could use some help." And the Buddha says, in effect, "Well, thanks very much, but no thanks. We have plenty of bodhisattvas of our own in this world." And there emerges from the earth, which we understand to mean emerging from everyday life, there emerges from it, from the earth, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of bodhisattvas. Nobody's ever seen these guys before. They emerge from under the earth. Everybody is in shock. Wow! And they want to know, where did these guys come from? Who taught them? You can't have tens of thousands of bodhisattvas without somebody teaching these bodhisattvas. And Shakyamuni Buddha says, "Well, I did. And Maitreya," this is very interesting, you know, Maitreya should be obedient or believing in what the Buddha said, right? And Maitreya says, "Nobody's going to believe this. Nobody's going to believe this. It's like a 100-year-old man pointing to a little kid and saying, 'That's my father.' This is impossible to believe." And that is what the sutra itself understands to be the most shocking teaching in the text. But it's not the only thing that's shocking in this text. There are all kinds of things that are understood to be shocking. For example, well, the stupa that emerges in chapter 11. Stupa emerges out of the earth and hangs in the air in front of the congregation. And again, it's a longer story than I want to tell tonight, but eventually Shakyamuni Buddha goes up to that, into that stupa and opens the door. And inside is another Buddha from long, long ago named Taho, Many Treasures. And Many Treasures Buddha invites Shakyamuni to come inside. Now, in the tradition, even in the Mahayana tradition, there should never be two Buddhas in the same place at the same time. It's impossible. But in this story, Shakyamuni Buddha goes in, Many Treasures Buddha invites Shakyamuni to come in, have a seat. And that became, of course, an important subject for subsequent Buddhist artists over the generations of drawing this very unusual situation of there being two Buddhas sitting side by side. Obviously, the emergence of the stupa itself is shocking. Everybody's just knocked out when they say, "What is this?" And having these two Buddhas sitting side by side is also shocking. There's just chapter 12. Yeah, there are two stories in chapter 12. The title is Devadatta. Devadatta is known by everybody in Buddhism as the epitome of evil. He's a guy who's tried to kill the Buddha on two or three occasions, has tried to split the order, and probably, in fact, historically did that. There probably were several centuries of a continuation of Devadatta's, I'm hesitant to say what, school of Buddhism, maybe. A more rigid, a more strict school of Buddhism than Shakyamuni's. Anyway, again, to make a longer story short, the text says, or Buddha says to this embodiment of evil, Devadatta, "You too are going to become a Buddha. I've learned a lot from you. And you too are to be a Buddha in some future age." Well, this is, this became a subject of a lot of debate in both in India and in China over the question of whether there's anybody who's so bad that they can't possibly be saved, can't possibly become awakened, can't possibly become a Buddha. The Lotus Sutra's answer to that, and in the debates, the Lotus Sutra was used. And finally, everybody agreed with the Lotus Sutra's position that no, there's no one so evil that they cannot become awakened eventually, given enough time. So that's kind of shocking to say that this embodiment of evil, the guy who tries to kill the Buddha, he too is going to become a Buddha. Second half of the chapter is about a child, a girl. The dragon princess, the daughter of a dragon king who lives under the sea. And it's a longer, interesting story. But in the end of this story, well, actually, Manjushri, who's been traveling around, he's traveled around a lot, so he's visited the dragon kingdom under the sea. And there's a Shariputra, who's the leading bodhisattva, leading shravaka, leading monk, and another bodhisattva, who's one of the leading bodhisattvas. Manjushri tells them, they ask Manjushri, "Have you ever in your travels seen anyone who's capable of becoming a Buddha instantly?" And Manjushri leans back and says, "Yes. There's a little, I forget, 7 or 8 year old girl." And he goes on for a long while about all of the virtues, all of the wonders of it, how brilliant she is and how compassionate she is and how she's learned the texts and on and on and on. And she is capable of becoming a Buddha instantly. Well, Shariputra says, this is not believable. A woman's body is too filthy to receive the Dharma. Never mind to become a Buddha. Everybody knows that to be a Buddha, you have to have a male body. And the Bodhisattva says, you know, it took Shakyamuni Buddha many, many, many generations to become a Buddha. And you think you can become a Buddha instantly? You've got to be kidding. And she turns, the little girl turns to these two guys, and she says to them, watch. Just watch with your, and here I don't know what word to use, watch with your special eyes. In the West, I suppose we may say your God-given vision or something like that, your real ability to see. Just watch. And she does become a Buddha instantly. She goes off to the south and in an instant is beginning to bring a lot of people to awakening. Well, you know, in a tradition which says a woman's body is too filthy to receive the Dharma, it is shocking for an 8-year-old girl to become a Buddha. Well, I could go on like this for the rest of the evening. There are a lot of shocking stories in this book. Chapter 10 isn't the only one. But in chapter 10, and that's what I came here to talk about this evening, is chapter 10. In chapter 10, the very beginning, the Buddha to the assembly, and we're told who's in this assembly. It's not only Shravakas and Bodhisattvas and men and women. It's also non-human beings and people of all sorts. And Shakyamuni announces in the very first paragraph of chapter 10 that all of these people, all of these living beings, all of these living beings are, if any one of them embraces even a tiny bit of the Dharma, they too will become a Buddha. And he goes on and says further, if anyone asks you in ages to come who are to become Buddhas, what sorts of people are going to become Buddhas in ages to come? And again, he turns to this mass of living beings in front of him and he says, they are. All sorts of people are the ones who are going to become Buddhas. And what this is about is, I think, a special kind of equality. In the Lotus Sutra, there are at least two kinds of equality. In chapter 5, we have a, sometimes called a parable, but it's really a simile, about plants. And again, it's fairly simple. In this simile, the Buddha is likened to a great cloud, covers the whole earth. And of course, you know, in India at the time this sutra is written, just about everywhere at the time this sutra is written, the world is flat. So they're not thinking about covering the whole globe. The Buddha is like a cloud covering the earth, and the Dharma is the rain which falls on the large trees, the medium-sized bushes, the little plants, equally. Nourishes all living beings equally. This is a very, and it uses the term equally frequently, this is a very explicit teaching of a kind, what I would call a kind of passive equality. That is, everyone is capable of receiving the Dharma. The big trees, the great people, the medium-sized plants, and the little plants. All are equally capable of receiving the Dharma. But here in chapter 10, the Buddha announces that everyone, all living beings, are equally capable of teaching the Dharma. Not just receiving it, but teaching it. And we probably don't have a lot of Theravada Buddhists here, so I don't need to be afraid of insulting anyone. But I think this is really one of the big divides in Buddhist history. In the classical tradition, which is kept alive today in the Theravada tradition, the emphasis is primarily on handing on the tradition from generation to generation, preserving the tradition. It's almost as though they were walking backwards, trying to preserve what was taught 2,500 years ago. But in the East Asian Mahayana traditions, and also to some extent, maybe equally, in the Vajrayana traditions of Tibet and Mongolia, there's an emphasis on not only perpetuating the Dharma, but on developing and growing it. And that's what this idea of not only receiving the Dharma, but teaching it, developing it, bringing it along. So this is a kind of active equality. Not only receiving the Dharma, but also teaching it. I'm not doing a good job of following my notes, so bear with me. What this idea that everyone can equally be a teacher of the Dharma does is to break through in a rather decisive way what you find in earlier chapters of the Lotus Sutra and in most of Buddhism, namely a kind of hierarchical ranking of living beings. One of the classical ways of putting this is in terms of the 10 realms, but that's probably more than you need for now. But there are four holy realms: Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Pratyeka Buddhas, Shravakas, human beings, heavenly beings. This is very much of a hierarchy. And this teaching that everyone, this use of the term Dharma teacher, Dharma Banaka in Sanskrit, this use of the term of the Dharma teacher as a kind of category, as a kind of description of what people can be, is a way of breaking through that hierarchical structure to say that in principle there's no difference between a Bodhisattva and a Pratyeka Buddha and a Shravaka and a Buddha. In chapter 10, anyone, a bodhisattva, a shravaka, a man, a woman, a layperson, a monk, all can equally become Dharma teachers. Absolutely anyone. Wow. So, of course, here again, the teaching of the Lotus Sutra is what I call existential. The intention of the Lotus Sutra is what I call existential. Namely, that if anyone can become a teacher of the Dharma, it means, most importantly, that you and I, can be teachers of the Dharma. Not only great bodhisattvas or great leaders, whether they be Zen leaders or Nichiren Shu leaders or Jodo Shu leaders, no matter what kind of people we're talking about, we ourselves can also be teachers of the Dharma. Very ordinary people, people of limited understanding and limited faith, can join in doing the Buddha's work. Even if it's only a matter of understanding and teaching a very little. This is kind of shocking. Everybody by now, I suppose you all know, that to be a teacher, you have to have credentials. Generally, to be a Dharma master, a great teacher in Buddhism, even in East Asian Buddhism, you have to have an appropriate teacher, and you have to have that teacher's authorization to teach. Even in Risho Kosakai, with which I'm associated, where the founder is posthumously known as the great Dharma teacher. Even there, you have to have credentials to be called, quote unquote, a Dharma teacher. And you have to go eventually, if you become a Dharma teacher, you're brought into a ceremony, given a certificate that makes you a Dharma teacher. But in chapter 10, the Buddha tells Medicine King Bodhisattva that if anyone wants to know who will become Buddhas in the future, he should tell them that the people before them, all sorts of people, including very ordinary people, will become Buddhas. You realize how crazy this is, how unorthodox, how difficult to understand or to accept? What does it do, for example, to the term bodhisattva? Just briefly, in the Lotus Sutra and generally in East Asian Buddhism, there are two meanings of bodhisattva, two uses of the term. It's used in the first place as a kind of title for very great, well-known, basically mythological bodhisattvas. There's one sitting under the Buddha over here. This is Manjushri, Maitreya, Guanyin, Fugen, I call him Universal Sage, Jizo. They're only really in East Asia, there are about five really, really well-known, very popular, great bodhisattvas. And they, in important ways, can be kind of models for us. You know, except for Jizo, who doesn't really appear in the Lotus Sutra, the other four all have prominent roles in the Lotus Sutra itself. They're important because they can symbolize great virtues such as wisdom, compassion, and be models for what we, how we could behave. But additionally, as I mentioned earlier, in earlier chapters of the Lotus Sutra, we're told that Shravakas, beginning with Shariputra, can become, are already, in fact, bodhisattvas on the way to becoming Buddhas. But we never, ever find the expression anywhere that I know of. I'd be glad to be corrected, but I don't think you can ever find the expression Shariputra Bodhisattva. The Lotus Sutra says he is a bodhisattva, but he never gets the title of bodhisattva, the badge of whatever it is. So here a somewhat different use of the term bodhisattva is being made. The term does not so much represent a rank and a status as it does a kind of interrelational activity. A bodhisattva in this case is somebody who's on the way to becoming a Buddha and is therefore a bodhisattva, always is a bodhisattva for someone else. But with the term bodhisattva associated in our minds with Manjushri and Guanyin and Maitreya and Jizo, with these great gigantic figures, when we have that association in our minds, it may be difficult. It may be very difficult to believe that we too could become a bodhisattva. And we might think that I'm too young or too old or too sick or too poor or too stupid or too something else to be a great bodhisattva. It's impossible. And this is where the idea, I think, of the idea of the Dharma teacher is especially important. It may be hard to believe that you can be a bodhisattva, but not as difficult to believe that you might be a good man or a good woman who explains even a phrase of the sutra to a single person, and therefore is a messenger of the Buddha, therefore is doing the Buddha's work. The Lotus Sutra basically teaches that you can do it, and this is one of the sutra's devices for trying to persuade you that you too can be a bodhisattva for someone else without using the term bodhisattva. You become a Dharma teacher, which actually amounts to the same thing. Also, I think terribly important here, almost never recognized, is the fact that the gender gap, so often prevalent in Buddhist texts, including in some parts of the Lotus Sutra, is decisively broken through in this chapter. Any good man or good woman, the text says, consistently. It never says any good man. It's always got good man or good woman. Any good man or good woman who explains even a phrase of the sutra to a single person is a messenger of the Buddha, one who does the Buddha's work. Today, our world, I believe, is faced with numerous worldwide issues and challenges. Global warming, environmental pollution, depletion of natural resources, threat of nuclear weapon proliferation, population growth, growing economic disparities between rich and poor, economic insecurity all over the place, dysfunctional nationalism, and one could, of course, go on and on. In my view, we will not make progress on any of these major issues without the leadership of women. Without, in other words, gender equality, or at least movement in the direction of gender equality. And when it comes to this, when it comes to issues of gender equality, Buddhism is more a part of the problem than it is of the solution. Like other religions, all other major religions, Buddhism promotes gender inequality, even to this day. It promotes the superiority of male monks over nuns, even today, where Buddhist institutions in Taiwan, for example, are being run by nuns. The most educated, enlightened nun, no matter how accomplished, is to be obedient to the lowest, youngest, dumbest monk. Now, it doesn't actually always work that way in practice, of course. But nevertheless, in principle, Buddhism asserts the superiority of men over women. It promotes the superiority of men over women who are all too often pushed into the kitchen.
Amen.
In India, not one of the famous bodhisattvas is a woman. All bodhisattvas, all people with the title of bodhisattva are male. In chapter 13 of this text, we learn that the stepmother and the wife of Shakyamuni Buddha are to become Buddhas in the future. But nowhere do we ever see anybody referring to Mahaprajapati as a bodhisattva. Regarder of the cries of the world, Guan Yin, in chapter 25, will take on, well, actually both Guan Yin and another bodhisattva by the name of Wonderful Voice will take on, said to have the ability to take on any form that anybody needs in order to be saved. And a lot of those forms are female. So there are positive dimensions of being female, even in the Lotus Sutra outside of chapter 10. But, and this Guan Yin Bodhisattva of the chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra will, in time, take on female characteristics. And probably the majority of the images of Guan Yin, this one I suppose is ambiguous with respect to gender. A lot of the images of Guan Yin from the 10th century on, 11th century on, will be female. And she will even become popularly known as the goddess of mercy. But this is 10 centuries after Buddhism moves to China. It took a long, long, long time to begin to associate the notion of being a bodhisattva with being a woman. So it's no accident, I believe, that the Lotus Sutra, Chapter 10, repeatedly uses the expression good man or good woman. It wants us to understand, perhaps men more than women, it wants us to understand, not just to understand mentally, but to actually embrace the teaching that whoever we are, male or female, we can teach the Dhamma and be a bodhisattva for others. And if we can realize that we ourselves can be a teacher of the Dhamma, it is only a short step, maybe not even a step at all, to realize that anyone else can be our Dhamma teacher, a Dhamma teacher for us. And when we reach that double realization that I am a teacher of the Dhamma, I can be a teacher of the Dhamma, and anyone else can be a teacher of the Dhamma for me. When we reach that double realization, we have truly, I believe, embraced the wonderful flowering of the Dhamma that this text wants us to understand. I'm afraid it's getting late, so I'm going to skip some things and just go to the very obvious conclusion that we too, whether male or female, ordained or not ordained, profound in wisdom and practice or not, we too, with compassion, with gentleness, patience, and understanding of interrelatedness, we too can all truly be Dhamma teachers, both teaching others and learning from others. We too can turn the Dharma wheel. It's maybe a little crazy and a little shocking, but that's what is true. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Gene. Before I open this to responses, comments, questions, what I was going to say in the introduction and didn't remember to is that the Lotus Sutra, the Dharma flowering sutra, is very, very important in the tradition that we practice here of Soto Zen, Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, quotes the Lotus Sutra very often, and Dogen also talks about doing the Buddha work. That's the heart of our practice, all of us doing the Buddha work, as Gene was saying. And in fact, chapter 10 that Gene was talking about, there's a phrase in there that Dogen wrote a whole chapter about in Shobo Genzo, the entire body of Buddha appearing and seeing how and really what it means is that each of us can express the whole body of Buddha through, as Gene was saying, this flowering of doing the Buddha work. So I just wanted to add that. And I really appreciate, you know, your expression of this for us, and including especially the point about gender and how important it is in America for women to express, for men to understand that women express the Dharma and can teach the Dharma and can do the Buddha work. So comments, questions, responses, questions for Gene, please feel free. Yes, Will.
Yes, I was a little bit distressed to hear about Buddhism being part of the problem when it comes to gender inequality. And I had heard from a few people that in Japan, for example, Buddhist practice and the priesthood is often very gendered. And I'm curious as to people's impressions and experiences around Buddhism or Zen Buddhism in America, how much that's true here, or whether it's different.
Okay, so would you respond to that as a woman who's actively practiced in American...
I'm the only woman in here.
Well, you and I are the two ordained people here, and you've experienced a lot of other Americans and places. Other people may also have things to say, but can I call on you, please?
Yes. Ongoing concern I have. And I really want to thank Jean very much for so nicely stating the obvious. And there's some subtle things that occur that marginalize women in our culture. And for instance, I rarely meet a male sewing teacher. I think I knew one that's transgender, but identified as trans man, but it's pretty rare. So there are things that are sort of very much divided. And, you know, I was watching the 50th anniversary webcast from San Francisco Zen Center. I'm going to take up to see that. And I thought it was pretty cool, but I was very aware that two kind of privileged white males were sort of the featured people. Even though there was a female actress hanging out in the background. I didn't see two of them, actually. But I really didn't see very much knowledge. I see, well, the next 50 years will there be a shift? But, you know, look at the politics in our country. Are there any major female political figures in our country that aren't called bitches if they're, you know, powerful? So I think it's pretty common. I mean, you work in tech, so how many women, women have some pretty serious issues, right, in that environment, the programmers, etc. So, what can we do about it is the question I always have. As a woman, is it good for me to be in the kitchen? I love the kitchen, and I love sewing, but I love lots of things, so I don't know. Thank you for bringing it up.
Thank you.
Other comments? I have some things to say myself, but go, first, Neha.
Well, I've heard of the Lotus Sutra from other people. I've never read it.
Could I persuade you to speak a little bit louder for my old ears?
You can try, but my voice doesn't carry very well. I've heard of the Lotus Sutra from other people, but I've never read it. So I'm assuming that I don't know when you translated the Lotus Sutra, but I'm assuming that you've been in contact with it for a while. So I'm curious, because you spoke very passionately about it. I'm curious when... Because with these two things that you spoke to us about, with gender and the two things that you spoke to us about tonight with gender and the chapter 10, I'm wondering when those two things kind of came to your attention as something that you felt were really important.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how to answer that. I was actually teaching in Chicago when I was invited to attend a seminar on the Lotus Sutra given by some leaders of Risho Kosekai, with which I've been associated ever since. And in preparation for that, that must have been around 1981. And in preparation for that, I read the then only, I think, English translation of the Lotus Sutra, which I subsequently came to think was a bad translation. But anyway, I read that translation, and I didn't like the book at all. I thought it was too full of praise of itself. It was too full of very strange English that I came to realize was not the fault of the text, it was the fault of a Japanese translator who didn't speak English, and then it was edited by an Italian who didn't speak English. So there were problems with that translation, but a with us still. Anyway, I didn't really like the text, and it was several years later when I moved to Japan and began to try to read the text in Chinese that I thought I found there something very powerfully empowering for people. I have been very much involved all my life in what at one time was called the civil rights movement, in various kinds of political actions. I don't mean getting people elected, but I mean in terms of trying to change the society in which we live. Sometimes with some moderate success, but obviously we've got a long way to go. And I thought that this text, much more than the Buddhism I had been taught as an undergraduate 100 years ago or so in college, was for me much too oriented toward learning doctrines and memorizing doctrines and being relatively passive with respect to the world. And I had, as I say, been a kind of social reformer or mender of the world. And I found in the Lotus Sutra a kind of Buddhist basis for being concerned about the world. I could give you another talk. I won't do it right now, but I could give you another talk on how the Lotus Sutra affirms, very powerfully affirms, the importance of this world and what we do with our lives in this world. It's a very this-worldly book in a lot of ways. And I gradually fell in love with this text. So it wasn't love at first sight, but I gradually fell in love with this text. And I still find it to be enormously empowering and enriching. And I never, ever read through a chapter of this text, including chapter 10 in preparation for tonight, when I don't find something there that I didn't see before, or some idea comes to me as a result of reading that text. So it's hard to put a date on it. It's an ongoing kind of process for me. And I would encourage you to, do you read Chinese?
No.
Well, in that case, I would encourage you to get a hold of this fellow,
which will be in our library soon.
And read the Lotus Sutra itself. It would be better if you could read it in Chinese, but if you can't read Chinese, lots of people, including Japanese and Chinese speakers, have to. In fact, this book was shocking to me. I don't know how it's doing now, but soon after it came out, it became a bestseller on Amazon Japan. Now, Risho Kosakai was selling it separately, so this didn't have anything to do with Risho Kosakai. And so a lot of Japanese people and Chinese people have told me that they understand the Lotus Sutra much better from having read my translation than they could from reading the Chinese or Japanese version. Because it's difficult.
And I wanted to second that. There are a number of translations of the Lotus Sutra. Some of them are okay, but Jean's is really excellent. So
thank you. So anyway, I would encourage you to read the Lotus Sutra. And it will encourage you, although there will be passages in it which you won't like. I can guarantee that.
Yes.
There are passages he doesn't like.
That's true, and I love the Lotus Sutra. But there's one whole chapter I won't talk about. But it's about time to stop and have tea, but there's so much more to say. I really appreciate your coming here. I really appreciate what you said, Hogetsu, although it's true that now we have a man who's Tenzo, and that we have had a woman work leader, and anyway, we have a lot of work to do, guys, in terms of supporting women to help us flower and help the Dharma flower. And so I think compared to, and this, it's a terrible thing to say, compared to the traditional monk Buddhism of Asia, American Buddhism is doing pretty well in terms of having women abbots and women leaders and ordained people and lots of women in roles, but still a lot of work to do. So I just want to say that. And this is also a reflection of our society, where, speaking of how this world is going, where women's health is very much under attack by some of our politicians, and something that we need to pay attention to. So I just want to add that. And
can I add just one more little
plug? Oh, take three.
For, I don't know now how long, 10 years or so, there has been a Buddhist women's organization called Sakadita. Mm-hmm. It's founded by an American Tibetan nun who's a professor at the University of San Diego. And it's a wonderful kind of thing. These women get together, thousands of Buddhist women come together from all of the Buddhist traditions once a year. Last year their annual meeting was in Bangkok, and this year, I forget when it is, I think it's later this year, their next meeting will be in India. And well, there are very, very few American Soto Zen women in that organization. I think the total number is around zero. I think. I could be wrong about that. So if any of you would and men are welcomed. You don't even have to be a woman to join Daughters, Sakyadita means Daughters of the Buddha. But if, there aren't a whole lot of women here tonight, but if any of you were interested in being a part of a very, very exciting development in Buddhism, I would encourage you to think about participating in Sakyadita.